Chapter 13. Fardarka's vessel was not large, but it was roomier than most of the others in the harbour. It had been many years since Mirku had last been on a boat. He stood still on the deck for a few moments after boarding, enjoying the movement of the sea and remembering his time with his father. "My father and I were all up and down this coast," he told Fardarka. "And so was I," the boat owner replied. "North well beyond Muirhivne and south nearly to the end of the Ichinsilig lands, and recently too, so I know the shifting sandbanks as well as the landmarks and harbours." He and Con, a cheerful blond young man, hoisted the square grey sail and the boat moved towards the harbour mouth. Fardarka took a small bronze ring from a pouch at his waist and threw it into the water. Mirku noticed Con blushing. "What was that for, Fardarka?" Mirku asked. "Well, I'm a good Christian, you know, but perhaps I'm a bit old-fashioned. When I'm starting out on a voyage, I feel it's a time to keep everyone happy, so I give a little something to Mananaan Machlir." "It would be more useful if you asked Patrick to intercede with God for a successful voyage, and you'd save a bronze ring." Out in the open sea there was a gentle swell. Small waves slapped the sides of the boat. Dunica and Oscar were sitting on the benches, already looking rather green. "No, it won't be really rough," said Fardarka, replying to a question from Oscar. "You'll soon get used to the movement of the boat. It's great sailing weather, sunshine and a steady breeze from the south." Then he brought the prow round to head north, leaving Invernahia behind. 2 days later, Fionnthann and Oisin arrived back at Sleaty and were immediately summoned to the abbot's house. Their return journey had been uneventful for the most part, though Oisin had managed to spear a fox that ran across the road. He looked forward to giving the foreskin to his girlfriend, but first Abbot A had to hear about their visit to Cuala and read Mirku's message. "Of course you are both to go back to Invernahia in 4 weeks' time," he confirmed. Meanwhile, Brother Fionn had examined the fish and wine and pronounced both to be of good quality. "Though much too expensive," sniffed Father Treasurer. Finally, Fionnthann and Oisin were released to go back to the estate, Fionnthann to say goodbye to his uncle Phelim, who was soon to leave for Ardbrecken, and Oisin to surprise a young lady with a right now rather smelly fox skin. The monastery's timeless routine continued. Abbot A thought deeply about Mirku's project and how best it could be handled. He studied Ulton's list of miracles with care. Shortly before the 4 weeks were up, he again dispatched the two young men with an ox cart to Invernahia. "And you'd better stay there until they come, or until you know for sure that they're not coming," he told them, knowing that storms, pirates, outlaws, or hostile clans could cause delays or worse. And in fact, it was well over 6 weeks, almost autumn, when the gatekeeper sent a novice running to tell the abbot and the prior, "Father Mirku and Brother Dunica are in sight." The community gathered round to welcome the travellers. Mirku and Dunica looked pale and tired. Oscar's right shoulder was bandaged and he had to be helped down from the cart. "Nothing fatal," he assured the crowd, "just a shallow slash from an outlaw sword, and the outlaw's in a much worse state." Despite his protests, he was hurried off to the infirmary. Abbot A was now getting about skilfully with his crutch. He sent Mirku and Dunica off to rest until the following day, when they could tell him about their trip. By that time, the abbot had decided that Prior Cuncus should also be present to hear their account. When they assembled in the library, Mirku first remarked that their safe return had been a sign of God's favour for the project. "At Patrick's intercession, I hope," he added, "because, God knows, we're going to enough trouble for him." Then he launched into his account of the voyage. "Not far from the Liffey mouth," he began, "there's an island named after Patrick. We decided to spend the first night there to find out why it was so named. There are only a few families living and farming there. It's quite a small island, but they have a tradition that Patrick did what we did, landed there on his way north. The islanders believed that Patrick had been heading directly north to Ullig territory and beyond, rather than going to Brega first as we were doing. And that, Father Abbot, would confirm what we heard in Cuala. We spent only one night on the island and reached Inverculpa at the Boyne mouth the next day. Fortunately, Dunica and Oscar were over the worst of their seasickness by then, and I had persuaded Fardarka and Con to stop making jokes about it. There were a number of merchant ships there, as well as ships belonging to local kings, fishing boats, and one or two craft that we suspected of being pirate vessels. Fardarka and Con stayed on board guarding the boat, and very alert they were. The first thing I did was to inquire about the Ulf Skownlawn, who we'd heard about in Ardbrecken, the one Uki called Anstadre, the Stammerer. He had died some years before, I was told, but I got directions to where his son lived. The son was now an Olav himself, a well-respected man of learning named Connell. His home was quite near the port, so I went there straight away with Donica and Oscar. Connell received us hospitably. I was glad to find he hadn't inherited the stammer, and his wife gave us a fine meal. We wanted to hear what he knew of Patrick's Tara episode, of course, but first we asked him about Cogitosa's mysterious note on question of deer, mead. Well, Connell thought about that for a while. Then he said he knew what it might be. It seems that at one point during Patrick's visit to Tara, King Laera summoned the saint and his entourage to come to him from where they were camped. The king didn't mean this to be a friendly meeting, quite the opposite. He wanted them killed because of conflicts they'd had earlier. As he and his druids awaited Patrick's approach, they somehow mistook the group of Christians for a herd of deer and lost the opportunity to attack them. This was regarded as a great sign from God. Connell speculated that a thick mist had drifted across the hillside, and also that King Laera and his chief druid may both have been short-sighted. If so, that of course didn't make it any less a sign of the Lord's favour, since God works through nature. Anyway, Donica and I were pleased that we had solved the mystery of the deer reference. So then we asked Connell to tell us about the whole Tara episode. He gave us a much more detailed account than the one we have in Ulton's book. He seemed to have done more research since his father spoke to Ulton. Donica has good notes of Connell's account, which we'll give you to read, Father Abbott and Father Pryor. I'll try to sum it up. Patrick reached Slane on Easter Saturday and lit the Paschal fire there in contravention of a temporary royal prohibition in honour of a pagan festival. King Laera went to Slane to challenge Patrick. There was a conflict and a druid died. Patrick summoned darkness. The king's people fought among themselves. There was an earthquake. Laera pretended to be ready to convert and called Patrick back to kill him, but mistook the Christians for deer. Patrick nevertheless came boldly to Tara the next day, where only Dhufach, with his young assistant Fioch, later our patron here at Sleaty, rose to honour the saint. In a series of contests with the druids, Patrick was victorious over fire and poison and dispersed snow that the druids had caused. Then Laera ceased to oppose Patrick and converted, genuinely or not, through fear. That roughly was Connell's narrative, gleaned from a number of sources that he regarded as reliable. But he was quite open about some matters that still seemed doubtful. One of these was Laera's conversion. Some, including Connell's father, thought the king had instead made excuses for not converting. Connell himself thought that the reference to an earthquake might have been symbolic, and perhaps the snow also. Donica, you had another question for Connell, do you remember? Yes, Father Mirku. I asked him, wasn't it surprising that there was a big pagan festival at Easter, when Samhain would have been a much more likely time? And Connell told me he thought that the druids had hurriedly invented a ceremony, or revived an obsolete one, when they heard Patrick was coming. After all, they knew what a threat Christianity posed to them. They'd already been issuing dire warnings and prophecies about it. They might have had long notice of Patrick's arrival, perhaps from British sympathisers, because, according to Connell, it was quite a big festival, attended by nobles, craftsmen and fortune-tellers, as well as druids. Then again, we know that tradition can go astray in 200 years. Perhaps a hastily arranged festival was confused with a traditional one. But I suppose we'll never have any certainty about that question of the pagan festival. Thank you, Donica, Mirku resumed. He had taken the opportunity to clear his throat and drink some water. Before leaving Connell, we rather hesitantly mentioned the question of snakes. You'll recall that was Cogitosa's other brega note. Well, Connell just laughed and said no one took that seriously, except maybe as a tale for young children. If we liked, we could ask a knowledgeable Shkeli about it, the one Ulton had met, known as Bael Ving. Sweetmouth had died years before, but his successor and nephew lived in a settlement not too far to the west. He was a knowledgeable and sensible man, unlike his late uncle. As it happened, I stayed with Connell longer than I expected. I fell and twisted my ankle on leaving the house and had to be carried back in. Couldn't walk for days. You know how it is from your own experience, Father Abbott. Very frustrating. A lot more so for me than for you, growled A. 2 days is nothing. Get on with your story, and I'll have something to say about that Tara business when you're finished. So then, Mirku continued, I sent Donica on ahead with Oscar to interview the present Shkeli, Lurkhan by name. Explain how it went, Donnacha. Yes, certainly, Father Abbot, Father Prior. Oscar and I hired horses and rode west for a couple of hours to reach Lurcan settlement. You were pretty sore when you arrived, I'll bet, said A, amused. Oscar wasn't. He often rides horses. But as for me, I hadn't done so for years, and sore hardly expresses it. I could hardly walk at first when I got down. Anyway, we found we had arrived at a very prosperous-looking riverside settlement. Fat cattle grazing nearby, fish traps, and a watermill in the river. Strong protective rampart on the land side. Inside there was a fine house with a number of smaller dwellings around it. The big house was Lorcan's home, and he seemed glad to receive us. I saw he had a desk and writing materials, unlike most Scaelithe. Wood carving tools, too, and some beautiful carvings he'd done himself. He was the head of the settlement, though still fairly young, and... Would you ever get to the point, Donnacha? Conca intervened. We don't need a coloured picture of this Lurcan. What did he tell you? I'm almost there, Father Prior, Donnacha replied calmly. The wood carving has some relevance because he gave us a present of a very expressive statuette of Patrick, which we have here for you. Also, Father Mirko has told me that the character of the narrator often illuminates the narrative. That's my view, yes, said Mirko. Right, Abbot A intervened. Let's get on with it. Donnacha took up his account again. Lurcan was learned, versatile, and precise. He was rich for his age, too, which gave him leisure to pursue an interest in history in parallel with his activities as a storyteller. He spoke very frankly about his uncle and predecessor, the man known as Bael Veing. My uncle had a mischievous character, he said. He had extraordinary powers of persuasion. He'd fix his eyes on you and convince you of nearly anything. There was nothing he liked better than taking some misunderstood incident and making people believe it was a piece of history. That's what he did with the story you speak of, the story of Patrick and the snakes. Of course, any sensible person would stop believing it after being free of Bael Veing's influence for a while, as you tell me was the case with Bishop Ulton. No real scholar will ever take it seriously enough to write down, but an exciting tale like that could float around among the people for hundreds of years. Bael Veing was very good, too, at persuading wealthy people to supply him with generous gifts. He hoped to raise his Éirigh honour price, and thus his social standing, by becoming a Brugi hosteler, but he died before he could do that. He used both his riches and his persuasive powers to convince me that I should succeed him as a Scaelí, though at the time I'd have preferred to be a warrior. He had no children, you see, never got a wife. I think women saw through him more easily than men. But I have to say he was a kind person and a gifted storyteller in spite of his flaws. We asked Lurcan about the Tara episode, and he gave us an account that differed from Connell's only in some small details, names of the druids, for instance, and the exact cause of death of the druid who died. Lurcan said he fell or was thrown onto a rock. I asked whether he thought we should seek out further learned sources in Brega. His opinion was that no one in the area could tell us more than he and Connell had. So after thanking Lurcan, Oscar and I travelled back to Connell's house near Unverculpa for the last part of the journey. I walked, leading the horse. We found that by God's grace Father Mirko was recovering, and the boat was safe. I wrote up my notes. Oscar took over guard duty on the boat for a while to allow Fardurka and Conn some time to enjoy drinks and pleasant company ashore. The next day, we sailed north. Thanks, Donnacha, said Mirko. I'll take it from there. We set a northeast course towards the great inlet in the Ullig territory, the one with a very narrow mouth. It's almost like a little inland sea, and from the north end of it, Bangor Monastery is quite a short journey. We were lucky again to have a strong southwest wind behind us, though it was veering round a bit. I could see that Fardurka was looking worried. Is it because the sky is darkening? I asked him. It was only early afternoon, and we were about opposite Merhevna. Not just that, he said. It's bad to show the ill-omened left side of our boat to all the populated places to the west of us. That obviously couldn't be avoided, I told him. But Donnacha and I then said prayers to avert any misfortune. The wind got stronger again towards the end of the day. There were some rainy squalls, and we were tossed around a good deal. Donnacha and Oscar were too busy bailing out water to feel seasick. Even the old sailors, such as myself, felt quite relieved when Fardurka skilfully steered us into the great inlet where the waters were much calmer. We landed for the night at a small settlement near the shore, and spoke to a few men of learning who lived in the vicinity. When we mentioned our interest in Patrick, they told us of some well-supported local traditions about him. The main one was that Patrick and his companions had also landed there, and had been befriended by a man named Diocou. This Diocou was a virtuous pagan who was converted to Christianity and looked after their boat while they went further north. Then when Patrick and his companions returned, they spent several days travelling around Diocou's territory, preaching and baptizing. Dunica's notes have more detail on all this. In the morning we sailed or rowed at times because the wind had dropped, until we reached the northern end of the inlet. We left our boat there, well guarded by Fardurka and Con, while I pushed on to Bangor Monastery with Dunica and Oscar. I think you, Father Abbot, have been to Bangor, but it was my first time seeing it. I found it very impressive in its learning, piety, and material strength. Hospitable, too. My opposite number there, the Master Scriptor, arranged a guide and a horse-drawn cart for us to visit Slemish Mountain and the areas around it. The guide was a quiet, competent monk who got us safely through the rather disturbed border country between Ullig and Dal Náirge on both the outward and return journeys. That those areas, and especially Slemish, were closely associated with Patrick was a certainty for everyone at Bangor and beyond. At Slemish, a cross has been erected at the place where Patrick is said to have stopped on his return. There's also a mark in the rock that local people say is the footprint of Patrick's intimate, the Angelic Victoricus. Many go there to pray, and it seems their prayers are often granted. After our visit there, and having made our inquiries, we returned to Bangor, and from there to our boat. It was safe and sound, thanks to the protection of God and Patrick, as well as Fardurka's and Con's vigilance, of course. So that was your itinerary, said A, plus a bit of holy sightseeing. Now, who did you talk to, and what did you find out? Here again, I'm going to give you a summary as I did for the Tara episode. Dunica has detailed notes which we can leave with you. By the way, Dunica, your notes are all clear and legible, aren't they? They certainly are, Father Mirko, said Dunica indignantly. You saw me writing them up every night. I was putting my rough notes of the day in fully readable form. I might even say in elegant form, if modesty permitted. Well, you've won that battle against modesty anyway, said Prior Cunchod. We'll be looking forward to reading those wonderful notes. All right, said the abbot wearily. Proceed, Mirko. Very good, Father Abbot. You'll remember that three of Cogitosa's notes were for investigation up north. Patrick's owner, Patrick's possible return visit to him, and Patrick's death. We discussed these questions and more with several people. The three most important were the Master Scriptor at Bangor, a scholar historian at the house of a Tuath king in Ullig, and a scholarly Brehev living near Slemish. There were few enough differences between their accounts, and those mostly on details. An interesting thing was that both of the first two I've mentioned had read the material on Patrick in the Armagh Library. Much of what they told us seemed to be based on that. The abbot looked up sharply. Did they ask you why you weren't going to Armagh? They did, Father Abbot. And what did you tell them? I told them our abbot had given us strict instructions about the timing and itinerary of our pilgrimage, I called it, and we had to obey, of course, and that was no lie. No, Mirko, I suppose not. Well, as to Patrick's owner, they all said he was a local king. I mentioned that Ulton's book had spoken of him as a druid, one of four druids, apparently, but our informants were rather vague about that. They all said the king's family was a druidic one, and that there were several brothers. But was Patrick's owner a practicing druid himself? They weren't sure. But his name was definitely Miliuk, and he was definitely a king. That brings us to the question of whether Patrick returned to Miliuk directly from Inverness. Abbot Ea stood up and announced that he was going to walk up and down the library because he was getting stiff. But I'm still listening, he said, so go on with your story. All our informants, Mirko continued, agreed that Patrick had gone straight to Miliuk from Diocou's territory, his first landfall in Ullig. Those who had read the Armagh material thought he had already been in Tara and other places well before that, whereas the ones who hadn't read it believed, as we do, that he had come directly from Inverness with only an overnight stop at the island named after him. The Master Scriptor at Bangor had an idea, one that had come up already in the Ulton Tirachon discussions, that Patrick was eager to see Miliuk's children. Patrick may have taught them on the quiet, perhaps even converted them while he was a slave. It occurred to me to wonder, Father Abbot, whether if the voices Patrick heard calling him were from Silva Virgulti instead of Silva Focluti, as Ulton saw in the Clonmacnoise copy of the Confessio, the voices could have been those of Miliuk's children. But none of our informants had any such idea. They only seemed to recognise the Silva Fuclutti reading and assumed the wood was in Connacht. "You'd better assume that too," I intervened. "That other of your idea of yours is too speculative, I'd say." Our informants believed, Mirko went on, that the motive for the visit was what we'd heard in Coola, to convert Miljuk, but also to compensate him financially for the loss of his slave years before, in line with custom and practice. In the event, Patrick didn't have that opportunity. When he approached Miljuk's house, he saw that it was burning. The fire had been started by Miljuk himself, and he had died, by suicide, they thought, in the flames. He probably assumed the Christians would take revenge on him, seize his property, try to convert him forcibly. No one knows for sure. Mirko stopped as he noticed a whispered conversation starting up at the door of the library. Two strangers had entered. They were being discreetly ushered out by Father Librarian, who had been successfully effacing himself up to now. The strangers disappeared, and A called. "What's that about?" The librarian hurried over. "Two young scholars from Clonmacnoise who want to consult some of our books, Father Abbott," he said. "I sent them off to wait in the guest house until you finished here." "We've an hour or two to go yet, I'd say," the abbot told him. Mirko nodded agreement. "Please go and tell them in the guest house to give the visitors a good meal with ale with the abbot's greetings, and I'll greet them in person later." The librarian went off to deliver this message, and Mirko took up his narrative again. "Now we come to Patrick's death. We heard and noted down quite a lot about this from our three main contacts. I'll give you the outline. Patrick was back in the north after years of missionary work in Leinster and Connacht. He fell ill there and knew, informed by an angel we were told, that he would die soon. Knowing this, he arranged to be brought to Armagh. But another angelic message from Victoricus via a burning bush said he should go to Saul, not Armagh, to meet his end. Of course, those two places were in rival territories. So his bearers turned east. Donica and I, discussing this afterwards, thought that the first as well as the second message might have been from Patrick's old friend Victoricus, the angel in human form, as it were. Anyway, the narrative went on to relate that Patrick died at Saul in Ullig territory after seeking, and no doubt obtaining, certain favours from God. Those included a promise that Patrick's preeminence would be in Armagh, meaning that he and his successors would be its patrons, that on Judgment Day Patrick would judge the souls of all the Irish, and that divine mercy would be granted to Diocu's descendants. Then, for a time, the skies were unnaturally bright and angels were heard chanting as they kept vigil around Patrick's body. After that, the body was put into an ox cart, following a third angelic message, and the oxen were turned loose to go where they would. They stopped at Downpatrick, which is Patrick's burial place. There were two attempts by the Enail to seize the body by force. Both failed, one because of a flood between the rival armies, the other because the Enail got the wrong body and subsequently lost it in a river. Mirko paused. "I must stop for a while, Father Abbott," he said. "I'm losing my voice. But first I must mention that in our spoken accounts to you, we've stuck closely to the cogitosis points. We heard much else too, especially about the miracles and other events associated with Patrick and his travels around the country. Donica has those on separate tablets." Donica produced them from his bag and passed them to A, keeping them apart from his other tablets already on the table. Now Prior Cuncud was tugging at the abbot's sleeve and whispering to him. "Yes, yes, Cuncud," said A. "I have other work to do today," he announced, "and I must also speak to those visitors from Clonmacnoise. And I'm going to need some time to read all those notes of yours, Brother Donica. Mirko, we'll assemble again at midday tomorrow here in the library." Rain rattled on the roof as they rose to go. At the door, they looked out into a heavy downpour. Brother Librarian came up with two leather cloaks, which he gave to the abbot and the prior. He turned to Mirko and Donica. "Sorry, Master Scriptor, I only have two." "Quite all right, brothers," Mirko, philosophically. He and Donica raised their hoods and plunged out into the rain, Mirko to his own house, Donica to the scriptorium. "Thanks, brother," called A as he set off for the guest house. "We'll send these back when the rain eases off."